And rolling. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, everybody. This week it's Hagen's turn, and I have sat down preparing a document where I sum up some of my insights lately. We have any corrections from the other podcast?
No, the Docker one was perfect.
Yeah, and the Docker 2 was perfect too, because we never received any feedback.
so it must be good.
Yeah, it's awesome. Normally when you mess stuff up in the internet, you get like something.
A shitload of heat.
Yeah, and so no corrections today. I will be gone for holidays for 1 week, so we have another pause of 1 week with the podcast.
Yeah, we could do next Friday, I guess.
Are you back on Friday? No, I'm back on Thursday.
Yeah, but I have a friend visiting.
Again
from Indonesia, actually.
Oh, this guy.
And then he's visiting on Wednesday and Thursday, so I'll be on Friday again. But yeah, we'll see. Otherwise, we will.
Okay, so. Yeah, so I got this book from Martin Kleppmann called Data Intensive Applications, or Designing Data Intensive Applications. Lately I was doing some work with like designing or thinking about how to properly set up a data pipeline. And with data pipeline, it's not a complete generic data pipeline, but it's more about like the operational data that flows back from system that do their whatever they do stuff, and then we get back metrics, logs, and mostly events, and that we feed into a data pipeline. And after I thought a while, I thought that you could see this data as like, yeah, the operational history. So for every point in time when you start recording this data, you can basically see how your system does if you do a good job in providing and measuring the right stuff. But this data pipeline basically enables you to reflect and learn from your system. That's usually done by BI, but also like when
BI,
you do
business intelligence.
Business intelligence, of course.
So the guys pushing information to the management, basically what to do in the future, right? Is it fair enough to say this?
Yeah, then I think BI is also very vast in its like topics. You can optimize the business for more revenue. You can like only report to C-level management, but you can also do BI in terms of like engineering. You can also go and say, well, like Google does this with their hard drive analysis. So they found out that in the data centers, if they measure everything hard disk related, they can save some money by buying the right disk for their use case.
Yeah, but it's still a business.
It's business intelligence, but it has it feeds back to engineering, or it feeds back to management. That I think there is a distinction.
Is it fair to say it's data science? Without the topic operations, like just data science for the sake of the business itself. I mean, BI was still data science when data science was not a term even, right?
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think data science can be seen as a toolkit of tools that you use to analyze your data.
Yeah.
So like you have some methods that come from science, but then you have also some tools, and your business tries to be intelligent or more clever. Get more insights. Be smarter. Yeah.
Be smarter every day. Yeah.
With having a big fleet in a company.
And we are talking very generic, so it's not about any company we work or we worked for. It's just the generic stuff, right?
Yeah, and it repeats himself. So I've been working with like data intensive application, like from a bit of data to like a bit more of data to like really a lot of data. But I think the overall logic is quite the same. So if you are like in medium-sized data or like gigabytes of data, the Moore's law always works for you. So just at some point you can get everything to single machines. So you don't have to worry about concurrent programming so much, or you can basically do it with Python if you want to.
Yeah.
Not saying that Python is the bad choice, but Python is like not optimized for concurrent programming especially, and has like is that's not its main focus.
Yeah, but big data is always subjective, right? I mean, for someone, a 30 megabyte Excel file is big data.
Yeah, for a Pascal programmer or assembly programmer. I'm not sure, but it's right. I remember that there were systems from Yahoo that were implemented in C++ just to squash as much performance into one box to just get there and be on a one big heavy machine to do this task, and then not using any like make the fastest solution that's possible with the lowest amount of like data consumption.
High performance computing. There's a topic anyway. Reminds me.
Maybe that is true. But and today we leverage more machines. Anyways, the key point is that if you have this amount of data to store or go through, and you really want to store all the histories, so you have every day, and your operational every day is a new day, and every day gets data added. You have a lot of information, and you need to think about how to retrieve it, how to get it back, how to make sense out of it, and you also have to think about how do I compose these systems together in the way that I fulfill certain properties, and these properties are often said to be I don't know.
Do you mind if we start one step before and talk about the data itself and how to collect the data? I mean, you already talked about it, but
that's your topic. We should maybe make this a podcast before that and then shift them.
Let's kick out the collection stuff, but still, I would like to repeat what you just said, that you have metrics, logs, events. Yeah, and
don't sneak it in.
I don't sneak it in. But metrics is clear. It's like performance data over time, so time series data. Logs is just every log, every time-stamped event that is produced by the system, and events is subjective to your data or to your concern. Highlighted log, is it fair to say? Do you think?
I think it's fair, but it's not what's practically done at the moment. I think today what should be possible, in my opinion, is that you derive events by correlating metrics and logs.
That you create new, but isn't it that you create new logs out of logs and metrics? And it's just subjective to say, this log is more important to me. That's why I say it's an event.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also... You could design
a system with only logs. It's not that events is just like...
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. Yes, I completely agree, because sometimes I find code that goes... this happens and this happens here. So it does this within the code. So it has some internal metrics. And then at some point, there's it's in programming, it's called event listener. So on a specific fact on a metric, an event gets triggered. So callback, blah, and then a log message gets sent, event, blah, 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 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. I only think that you shift some implicit knowledge into a binary code version of some application somewhere in your huge infrastructure, and it's often hard to digest where it originally comes from. So if you go with simply a good paradigm how to log out of your application, another dedicated system like a data pipeline could derive events automatically from the given logs, yeah.
Yeah, and I think even in the application itself, it's good that you have a library that says logs and events, because you could do the same event stuff, as I said, with, or as we agreed, with logs, and just have a an additional, how is it called, this log level, like having debug, info, event, something. But then it's always in the power of the developer to change this and say, okay, oh, this is a log, and then I want to debug it, so I make it an event. But if it's explicit that he has to say log.info or event, then it's more, I think that's, it's more clear that this is an event and this is log, so that it's more...
Yeah, but that's what they do already. Like, they say, here's a special message.
Yeah.
Goes with the key event, and then send out a log with that key.
Yeah, but even...
It's still, like, the problem is that the developer is still in charge of deciding, mostly singular, while he is making the decision, or maybe in a pair, but most definitely not talking to a bigger group of participants in the company, like C-level managers. Are they interested in this? Other groups in the organization. It's still like, and what is also often seeable is that some logs or some programmers still just use this for their own debugging, and at some point they just set everything from info to debug, just so that they shift every message and clean basically their debugging output and shift them down, and then, or set the log level up, and that's it then.
Yeah, but guilty as charged. I think the same applies. I do the same.
Yeah, of course I do the same too.
If you write a program, then you nurse the program for half a day, and then you have the context of the program, so you're not thinking about which log level should this message have, so that someone without the context of having written this
and that's completely fine.
Meaning.
And that's if we Germans were in charge of doing it, we would have a special role in an organization, go for the Großinquisitor for logs. And then everybody would be unhappy. And now I think it's just that logging was kind of like, okay, the program is running and I can see what's happening. That's the naive like root of them. Now we do, this is apparently all what your product does, or it monitors, it should monitor and help get an insight of the whole system with like hundreds of applications, or like I'll say tens of applications, but hundred to thousands of servers. And yeah, that's not easy, because like the small developer on one application in this huge infrastructure has no meaning or context of the whole thing together. So
yeah, and
I think it will develop itself to that, because the means of lately as doing this in such a way is new, and we will find new ways to cope with that. At the moment we just store ridiculous amounts of logs and then use basically Elasticsearch to go through them, or
we as a community, you mean?
Yeah, like the ELK stack that came on, like basically it's put all your logs from all your nodes into Elasticsearch.
Yeah, and since data is a new oil, everyone is thinking, viel hilft viel. So
yeah,
everything you can think of, put it in your data pipeline, because someday, someone will say, I make some gold out of your data.
I wonder at this very moment how fracking would look like in an Elasticsearch index.
Mm. Yeah, so people storing in tons of data and think of it as the oil shell that they can frack. That's a good analogy.
Yeah, so
you put toxin inside of your Elasticsearch to frack out the good stuff.
I wonder.
This is maybe scripting, it's fracking. The Elasticsearch scripts. That's your toxic cocktail of fracking stuff.
Yeah, that works. So yeah, these data systems have some technical properties, and I find I don't think it's very new, but I think it's at the moment the most concise technical description for properties that a system should have is the reactive manifest. So I like it very much. It basically it says a system must be message driven, which basically refers to the fact that all data is immutable and it's like an append only. And we had this before when we talked about Kafka, that a system should never update in place any information or facts it ever saw, but only write them as an append-only thing somewhere. And Kafka is very popular, but you can also use HDFS for it. And with being message-driven, you enable yourself to be scalable, because now with this append-only, you can fan out from your append-only log to several processes, as many as you like, basically, if your append-only thing is horizontal scalable, which HDFS or Hadoop is, and Kafka is also. And you want to be resilient, which means in case of failures, you are like, you can cope with that failure. So even if hardware goes down, or even if data, and that's always a problem. We almost, like with the CAP theorem, the very popular one, we always think that the infrastructure or the systems are unreliable, but we have also like this factor of human errors, which go, ooh, I just updated this thingy, or I switched the time on this server, so all my log messages are 10 years old now. And then these go into the append log, be well ordered in terms of like delivering semantics, but not well ordered in terms of data semantics.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's an error from a human introduced into the system, not like the system failed or the disk failed or something.
Yeah, and what you just said, it's also true for this append log itself, right? So since you have only immutable data, you send it to this system of append log, and it's the only thing it has to do, and that's, I mean, it's more complicated than that, but the only thing it has to do, still saying it, is sending this immutable data to 5 nodes to have it replicated. And yeah, you do not have to take care of the CAP theorem in terms of, oh, I need to update this, and I have to make sure that they have the same data. So
not doing updates
is very good.
Makes a system very simple. And you just cut away a whole new like race condition based errors that you would have if you try to do concurrent updates in a distributed system. That's just terrible to do. And do we have visitors?
No.
But still, like Kafka does it in another way, right? Kafka does not push to clients, but you have a poll semantic. So the consumer is in charge of getting everything. And if and the data in Kafka is basically just there.
Mm-hmm.
And these human errors, they occur, and then companies mostly develop their own strategies of handling this. So yeah, that's always process based, basically. So you get a certain process for quality assurance, or like a process for several eyes principle, something like that. But there's another way, I think, which is a good way to start, is to think of the data of a company as like something that is a basis. Like if you do want to do BI, you need data first. And if you want to do BI, you need to be able to read the data, for instance, into your BI or data warehouse systems. Or if you want to search on data, you need the data to load the search system. And how can you do this? And how can you be sure that what you are reading is what you are meant to be read? No, it's wrong English. The thing is that the system changes, and maybe also the data changes. So what you want to do is you want to take care about something called reader-writer backwards-forwards compatibility. So
yeah. So just to sneak in, I mean, you store data over 10 years, and if you have to change your data storage somehow, right? That's what you just said, right?
Yeah, your system will just
change. There is change.
Yeah.
You cannot avoid change, or you should not avoid change. Maybe you even should embrace change, or make it easy to change. Let's put it this way.
Yeah, it's just like,
it should be easy to change.
If you want to adapt to the market, you want to adapt, you see a usage pattern, you want to add a new feature.
Or use some other system. Maybe Kafka does not scale over trillions of messages, and then you need something else, and then you should not.
Yeah, and then only what you want to save is your data. Your data should always be there and should always be readable and writable and manageable, despite a certain technology.
Should be agnostic.
Oh yeah, it should be agnostic to the technology. Good thing. So therefore, we have binary formats, or not far-fetched. So how do you do this? And there are several efforts of describing data, which is always like, traditionally, this has been markup. So the extensible markup language, XML, was one of the first.
Was ugly, wasn't it?
It's just very verbose. But what they did with the schema definition, so XSD files, or the data template definition, DTD, that was before that. Is it T? I don't know if T stands for template, but basically they describe every field in a, or every structure in a, in an XML. It's just very verbose. But then because it was so verbose, other attempts started, and you can now do the same thing with JSON basically, or with XAML even. It's just that you have one file that does your data definition. And what you also want to achieve is that you like inline the definition of the data with the data so that it's self-contained, which enables you, when you see something, you can be sure that you are able to read what's afterwards. And that's an old idea. That's header files. That's the header of like every container format, like an MPEG-4 or a video format or an audio format has this. It has a file header describing how to read the body of the header. And we even see this in HTML nowadays.
TCP.
Does the same thing?
Yeah, you have a header and then you have a blob of data.
Yeah, that's what we do. It's just that we now don't call it header anymore, I guess.
It's because you need a new name.
Yeah, it's just... and it's very important to think about this, because when you... In the designing data intensive application book, it's the case, for instance, the example is made with a rolling upgrade. So if you have one version of a program, you roll out a new feature and it adds a new key value pair to your data structure, and you make a rolling update of this. So you have two versions of a reader, for instance, in the system for an amount of time, and both need to read data that is old in the old format, and then you add writers, for instance, that add the new field that you want to have, and now you want to have a reader who can work with older data and with the new data. You want to have a new reader that also is able to read the old data and the new data, and you want to have a writer that is still writing backwards compatible data and forward compatible data. So and you need to think about.
Maybe I jumped too far ahead, but so you have two consumers and two producers. One is producing old, version 1, mm-hmm. and one is producing the version 2.
Yeah.
Do they produce in the same channel?
Yes.
And the readers, the consumers, is the one that's not able to consume the second version not consuming?
No, he is consuming, but, and that's the key point of, like, Avro makes it very easy to enable this.
And Avro we will talk about in a minute, I guess.
Yeah, Avro is a, like, technology. Is it? He will read the version. He knows that he's not knowing this newer version of the format he's reading, but he knows the older version of this and knows what kind of fields it can handle. So it will simply ignore the new fields. But still read the old fields.
But couldn't he reject this and say, okay, I don't want to read this? It's like,
The thing, you can do whatever you want then. The thing is that you're just not going to fail. Just not go and crash. You are basically need to handle this conflict at some point. You also don't want to have, like, I don't know, a certain amount of time where you do this rolling update where some messages don't get through the pipeline with this field or not. So in any ways, you need to handle it. The key point is that you don't crash and that you don't produce incompatibilities between a version upgrade, and that you can still go up until this point in the version schema I completely know what to do with that. And then here's a new version. I can go on doing my stuff in terms of the old version. Or if I'm a very smart program, I can grab the new version of the schema and behave accordingly.
Yeah.
That would be very smart.
That's too smart.
Maybe. Yeah, that's... Yeah,
don't but what you could do is update, if it's not Afro, which we, as I said, we'll talk about in a minute, but let's imagine the logic or the scheme is baked into the consumer itself, then what you could do is update the consumer first to the version 2, even though the producers are still producing the version 1,
yeah.
And then you update all the consumers, and then you can make sure that if the new produced messages in version 2 come, are produced, then the consumers can handle them because they know they are superior, they are senior.
Yeah, and you need to, like, you, these reader-writer problems that arise doesn't mean it's very simple or easy, or that every case in your business case is solved just by introducing this kind of technology. The point is, if you don't even care about versioning your data, you're going to the risk that after some years of production, you can basically throw away a whole lot of data because you have no idea what to do with them, and you cannot integrate them in a smart way because it's just too much of schema change, version change that you never get back in a semantically usable way. And that's important. And most people just go, well, we have this logger now, and we just store everything in Elasticsearch. What could possibly go wrong? And then
I think.
On Hacker News, they go, here's the most amazing new logger. Use this. And the developer goes, yes, I use this. And boom. Now you log in a completely different way. How would BI or a data warehouse cope with this change? Yeah, now you need to do a whole investment of doing a new ETL job that transforms, that does this job for you. And that you can avoid. You can just...
And it scales better, right? I mean, what if you have this ALK stack, Elasticsearch log slash Kibana, and then you have this log stash thing that provides this ETL for you, right? So, and if you change something in the producer, then you have this this middleware, so to speak, that does this the transformation to something that you expect to be, right? But if you could, and this is if you have like 1,000 servers logging in a certain way, then they will produce whatever the developer chooses to produce, and Logstash will transform it to something that conforms with what is considered good for Elasticsearch, or what the business thinks Elasticsearch should hold. And if a developer changes, then you have to change the Logstash job to transform it. But even better is if the logger itself only provides, like you said, version data structures that don't break, and where you do not have to have a bottleneck that provides transformation to a certain version or a certain scheme of the data, right?
Yeah, I think I agree. It's that at some point in your system, somewhere, you want to have version schemas.
Yeah.
And then from there on, you can do whatever you like, because now it's reproducible. Like, you have version schemas, you can go back and forth in versions of your data, and you have an append-only log, which has stored everything always, all the time, so you can go from any position in the time to any other position and fill back a system. And if you have ETL there and you want to do special things, you can do this, but the main point is that you have one source of truth, and you ensure technically with version schemas that you will always be able to read and write from that in the same manner.
Yeah, the lower in the stack you have this agreement of the data that is produced, the better it is, right?
Yeah, everything from there can be whatever you want it to be, but the data itself in the rawest form are the basis for everything else.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you wouldn't need.
And being a Linux container nuthead, I always try to scale down everything.
No,
no, just not, just. I don't say Docker.
He did. Oh, I did. It.
No, but so if you have the logger in your application, and hence the container produce the stuff that you expect to be in your Kafka pipeline, and the stuff that you expect to be consumed by your producer. You can even scale down the developer's environment just to say, okay, you have this application, and then instead of pushing it to Kafka, to your data pipeline, you directly push it to the producer, so you don't need a huge stack in between. That should be possible as well, that you just have your producer and it directly push to the consumer, maybe with a little one.
If you follow, yeah, it's just the matter of like what's the data you're sending around, and to which contract does it comply?
And then you can swap out your logger and check if it's compliant to all the consumers, because it's so easy and you do not have this bottleneck that you need a big logstash installation for your transformation. And so I really like it.
So coming back, there's this thing called Apache Avro, and it's currently in version 1.8.1. Somebody kills your microphone. It compares itself to Thrift and Protocol Buffers. Protocol Buffers is from Google. I don't know about Thrift, actually. Thrift is also Apache, but... Yeah, so... they say it's a data serialization system, and that's what the other ones say too. But it also makes a nice binary compaction out of the data, so...
So I have my log, right?
I have a problem with the serialization, but of course it is like you have an object or you have a function in your code, and it has some input and some output and some data structures, like a Java class or a Python object or a struct in C, and you want to write this down to disk. In Go, what do you have in Go?
No.
Oh, also a structure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you want to write this to disk, that would be called writing it down. It's like serial from front to end. You're writing it to disk. That's serialization, in my definition. But there are certain things to it. So how do you know how to write it back, read it back? How you know what to do with it? How is the file structured that you write into? Does it like has header files and offset definitions in the first 10 bytes or blah, 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 blah? All this is in the realm, the correct realm of serialization systems. And there have been a lot of serialization frameworks in the industry, but Avro enables you basically to have a reader-writer backwards compatibility. It has a nice compaction in the terms of it stores everything very efficiently in a binary data format. And it's used with Hadoop, Yarn, like with the newer Hadoop. It's the basis.
So it's basically, I have an Excel file and I want to store it as Excel 2013, Excel 2011. And they are...
I don't know, that would be a hard work to do.
Okay, maybe not Excel, but...
I mean, coming from a...
CSV. I store it as a CSV. And
you want to know how, like, every column, what is it? Is it, a number? Is it a string? It even supports, like, Avro even supports more complex structures, so you can have... like say an address, and an address by itself has a first name, a second name, a street,
so structures in
a zip code and a city. So you can even have this as called like my address, and this address contains of more similar and now simpler data types. You can do this,
so you can group or you can do structs within Avro and say okay, I have this. Okay,
they call it not structs, they call it rich data structures currently.
Structures, rich data structures, so rich structs, R structs, RD structs.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So, but you store it somehow, and at the beginning,
it's a whole framework. So,
and at the beginning, you put a version number or you put an identifier.
Now that's now something that is not special to Avro, but that comes from outside. Avro just enables you to serialize data now.
Ah. Okay.
In the way it does it, it defines schemas. So you can put the schema into one file and then read the schema and then read the rest of the file, like we mentioned already with head and body. But what you also can do is have a central repository where you store all your schemas.
Oh, wait, but the header is not a header of a file. It's a distinct file. So we have two files, the body file and the header file.
Ah, now I'm on weak ice, on thin ice. I'm not sure how they actually do this. I think it's like in the book, it has one page and it's a JSON. And on top of the JSON, there's the definition. And then inside this same JSON object is the data itself.
Okay, you could have it, but as you just described it, it seems that this definition, this header basically can also be fetched from something else, not the file itself. So you can...
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to mention now.
And I derail you the same the whole time. So
Avro doesn't care about like anything outside. It's just the definition and the reader-writer code that you get when you include the Avro binaries or library into your code base. You get the ability to serialize data in terms of Avro serialization framework with version schemas. But another question is, if you want to share, what does it buy you to have a central repository for all your version schemas? It buys you a lot, because now your whole organization can go to one repository and look up which versions of which schema is available.
And also for transportation, right? It's also, and we are not sure how this is implemented as of now, but if you have the header of the description of the content in the header of the package that you send, it's not very efficient, because you will send the information about the structure every time you send something. If you can swap this out and just reduce the header to an alias, so to speak, that says, okay, look...
Let's call it Universal Resource Identifier.
Yeah, unique Universal, UUID. No, UID, yeah. So you have this...
No, I mean not UUID, but I mean URI.
Yeah.
Like what they did in XML. So that's basically the same thing with XML schemas, only that it's not XML. Because you can put the schema into your XML file on top of your XML file and then describe what's beneath it. But you could also go, and that's what all the people do, under my organization, blah, 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 here is blah, 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 my XST file.
Mm-hmm.
And then you link in your XML file, this file complies to the schema here, and that's the URI. And then you pick up the definition from there. It's exactly the same thing.
And that's something that was invented last year, I suppose, right?
No, it's very old. I mean, the URI stuff, yeah, it comes from the, what's that, W3C?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. Is that how you say it in English?
I guess so.
Dup, 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 dup.
Dup, 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 C.
So, yeah. It's an old idea. Since we have the web and we can like put locators somewhere to point to different places in the web, it's easy. But in an organization, you maybe don't want to publish all your data. Depends on your organizational style. But so the key point here was that we have a version schema, forwards, backwards compatibility, and then a centralized stage where we register all our schemas for the organization, so that the data flows through our system into one single append-only storage solution that for all the time will always have these data in one order, the order the data arrived, and then it stores the data with a schema that is versioned, and there is a schema registry to it. And now you enable yourself or the organization to do whatever they like with the data from here on.
Mm-hmm.
They can create new data stores. They can fill other storage solutions. You can think of graph databases, search indices. Ooh yes. And columnar stores, time series databases, everything that's there. Maybe you can also get just one JSON file and create a Docker image out of it.
Whoa, now just, you got just, me hooked.
Yeah, just make it a data volume. Yeah, for every file, new Docker data volume. And that's the basis. And then that's very important and mostly overlooked, because everybody is so hooked into the technologies these days that you need to know what your data mean, what semantics you have in your data. And if you contract them down and if you nail this in a stable manner, you enable yourself to build systems that are message-driven, resilient, reliable, scalable. And then at the end, you are very responsive because you can add new things very fast, connecting to your master record or your ground of truth or your schema version data set.
But if I'm a startup here in Berlin, then why should I care about it? I mean, I want to.
Yeah, most often, like you aim for the first year. Yeah.
Get, show something.
Burn
nice.
The money. Burn the money.
Burn the money.
Show off. Get bought by some other company and.
And then let them
go buy an island.
Yeah, and then let them deal with the mess you created internally.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's cool.
That's what I hated the most of this startup scene thing, that you were not able to put something reliable and some well-designed internal stuff in place because it was never
hacker news-driven development or Stack Overflow-driven development. and that's fine. And that's actually
no,
like,
that's fine for the use case of showing off the front end and not caring about the back end too much.
I mean, what's it called? These incubator, or incubators are companies who help other companies start off.
Mm-hmm.
And I once saw a secret plan on a secret wall where there was just the interest of raising the value of this company and actually, like, okay, hot fix it by our secret engineering group so that the system from the outside looked working and you can
looked working.
Yeah, looked working and you get some stuff through and then be done with it. Not waste a whole lot of time of really serious engineering.
That's what I didn't understand, I think, back in the days.
Yeah, because there's no value in it. Once it gets sold, it's sold. Either the buyer will close it down just close it down and be on the market alone. Or he will put his engineering team into it, and then they would re-engineer it anyways. From a business perspective,
makes sense.
It makes sense to save a lot of money.
Yeah, it took me half a year to understand that.
But
I was very frustrated the half a year. Like, well, not very frustrated, but it was I didn't understand it.
Yeah, I think it takes some time, and you can, like, you as a developer or somebody who wants to work for a company. You can basically choose now. That's the consumer advice at this point from the show. If you want to be a heavy programmer doing serious engineering work, don't go to a Berlin startup. If you are hacker-oriented, massively producing new stuff, which has basically no future...
go to a startup in Berlin.
Yeah, do that. It's like it depends on what you want to do. And if you are like in a more conservative... organization, you will see that some serious amount and money has been invested to come up with really thought through engineering stuff.
That's
and
what we do.
That
we talk
I think,
about.
I think the skill that I earned is that I now can compare.
Yeah.
It's not all, everything is golden. Like, there are systems in the open source, but also in proprietary where you like, okay, here's a serious amount of engineering invested and but it still is like, but that's a general theme of like our industry is still very young, still very error prone.
That's a thing of humankind.
Well, I would still say that, I don't know, some engineering practices like bridges, houses, skyscrapers, that looks a bit more sophisticated than most of the stuff I see in code. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but society, but we are not a society podcast, but... I mean, if it works, some regions in the world, they are totally fine with what they came up with and they humble along with it. And some others try to perfect everything and screw it up in the end anyways. But anyway, we're not a society podcast. Yeah, let's move on and forget about it.
So that was reader, writer, backwards, forwards compatibility.
Where are we on this script? Like
we are basically the script talks.
Page 4?
No, the script is. I jumped right to the end of it.
Oh, that's good.
So we are almost done, but I will pick up on certain topics.
Oh, I would like
in the future.
To talk about the lambda and the kappa.
Yeah, but we're already 1 hour through.
Yeah, but just shortly, just so that I understand.
We already talked about it.
podcast. You never called it Lambda and Kappa.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, it was the second, first or second. Well, okay, we briefly mentioned it. I would actually go and have it in a later podcast.
Okay.
I'm basically through.
It was
It was about reader-writer backwards-forwards compatibility. It was about the reactive manifest and to get into the situation where you are 100% message-driven. Mention that the data contracts and the data are the basis for your whole company when you want to do something with data on a higher level, for instance, search or business intelligence.
And big data is no fun without data. Then it's just big.
Yeah, it's just big and trash, basically. If you don't know what your data mean, you cannot retrieve it or you cannot make any kind of sense out of it.
So yeah, I have an anecdote to that. When I went to, I forgot about, it was open source. It was the open, oh yeah, now it sounds really better then. It was open source data center something conference or so, and there was one guy from gutefrage.net, which is a website where you can ask any questions basically. Mm-hmm. Like I think it's like a Redis, this pre-Redis thingy, I guess. I don't know, I'm not sure about this, but anyway, you can ask questions like what's the necklace of Chancellor Merkel look like, and where can I buy it. So very timely bound questions, and they were storing all their metrics in OpenTSDB, and they were saying, yeah, we want this, every CPU metric we want to store in OpenTSDB because it's cool, and someday someone in a white knight will come and provide a big data system that extracts all the goodness of our systems, and so that we can know, and we store it for years and even for eternity, just for someone to get it, get the information and refine gas out of our data oil.
Yeah.
And I was stretching my arm and said, yeah, but where's the context? I mean, you have all this metrics of CPU and not, but...
At some point, your CPU was burning. And in some other point in time, CPU was very low.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
what does it mean?
Yeah, and once the CPU was burning and the network traffic was also high, but another point in time, it was totally the opposite. So there was no context about the metrics. And I was asking, yeah, for what? I mean, that's stupid, in my opinion.
It's just load, not load.
Yeah. So and you need to make sure that all the information are accessible and comparable and combinable. I mean, if you cannot only store metrics and no logs.
Yeah, and it makes no sense to, like, I mean, in logs, there's, like, I would say a higher dynamic in actually getting information, and there might be some hidden correlations that you might get if you do some machine learning on top of that. Yeah, but the metrics, I'm also very far from the metrics. But only metrics without anything my application actually did, where's the correlation to anything? It's just, load, it's like no
the,
load.
It's like the Audi slogan, power is nothing without control.
Ooh.
Ooh. But also the reverse is true, control is nothing without power. I mean, if you can steer your car very, very precise.
You could steer the Trabant.
Yeah, exactly. If you have a very nice steering in your Trabant, but you only have 35 horsepowers, doesn't make sense.
It was a chilling and relaxing drive.
Yeah.
And no hectic could be found.
Yeah, it's entschleunigt.
Yeah, we need more of that.
Yeah, we need more of that. Okay, so to conclude, we already concluded, right? We like reader backwards forwards compatibility.
This stuff.
We like to really like this stuff.
Yeah, it's cool. Important.
It's important, guys. Remember, it's important. Okay, cool.
Talk to you soon.
Yeah. Bye-bye. See you next time. And we like feedback, but without, we will continue, so you cannot shut up.
the torture is going on.
Yeah. Bye-bye.